people you are. Wonderful worship team. Man, that was good. I don't get that kind of stuff very often. That's pretty incredible. And a pastor, Pastor Nathan. He's been a great encouragement to me. We have a shape group that meets about once a month. Well, most of the time in the summertime. Sometimes we slow down a little bit, but we meet, and I never leave one of those meetings where he hasn't taught me something, because he's a sharp guy. I hope y'all know that. And made me laugh at some point. And what a communicator he is. Just a tremendous preacher. Communicates the Word of God as good as anybody I've ever heard. Reminds me of a story I heard some time ago about a man in Chicago. He's there and it's dead of winter. He's cold. It's freezing. He's tired of it. It's been below freezing temperatures for several days. And he decides that he's going to take a vacation. So he's going to go down to sunny Florida where it's warm. And he's going to take about a two-week vacation, get a resort down there, and take it easy for a while. Calls his wife up, tells her what his plans are, and says, you know, I'm going to Florida. I want you to join me down there in a few days. And then he catches a flight and takes off, and she's going to plan on leaving and coming down to meet him. And so she changes her flight and gets ready to meet him in Florida in a day or so. He gets there, he's at the resort, and he's enjoying his time there so far, but he remembers he needs to email his wife and let her know that he's arrived safely. So he emails her, but the problem is he chose the wrong email address. And the email actually goes to a widow lady in Iowa. The widow of a pastor, no doubt, who had died just days before, and she is there at the funeral. They're having the meal at her home. And suddenly she receives an email. Reads it, faints, falls to the floor, a loud thump crescendos through the home, and her children hear it, and they decide, well, we better go check on mom and grandmother, and they run in there, and there she is lying on the floor. And they start to investigate a little bit, and they notice that her computer's open, and they see that there's an email on it, and they go over and they read the email, and then it all makes sense. The email said, I have arrived at my destination safely. Look forward to seeing you tomorrow. Your loving husband. P.S. It sure is hot down here. Communication's important. And I hope that I'll be able to communicate effectively to you this morning with God's help. I want to talk to you about warnings. Warnings come on all kinds of things. They come on electronic devices. They come on prescription bottles. They're on road signs. Sometimes you even have them on the visor of your car. I was driving down this wonder. I didn't wreck trying to read it, but I was driving down the road in my car the other day, and I look on the visor, and there's a warning there. It says, warning. Children can be killed or seriously injured by airbags. I thought, killed? Man, that's serious. I want you all to know that there's a warning label on life. And in order to look at that warning, we have to go to the very beginning. When I'm talking about the beginning, I'm talking about in the beginning, God. Where God created man, where He created the universe, where He created all that we see. And it's there that we find the warning. It's in the book of Genesis. Genesis chapter 2, verses 15 through 17. And I want you to know Genesis was written about the beginning, but it wasn't written in the beginning. The author of the book of Genesis and the other first four books of the Bible was written by a man named Moses. And Moses wrote this to the Israelites so that they would know what God was up to when he created man, that they would know how life works, and that they'd be able to avoid the mistakes that were made in the beginning, that they'd be able to move into the future victoriously. Let's read Genesis chapter 2, verses 15 through 17. It says, "Then the Lord God took the man and put him in the Garden of Eden to tend and keep it." Let me just say real quick before I finish. From the very beginning, God gave man work to do. If there's any women in here that are in the dating stages and your man doesn't want to work, get rid of him. It's just going to get worse. Said in the beginning, God gives this warning, and in verse 16 he goes on and says, "And the Lord commanded the man," here's the warning, "of every tree of the garden you may freely eat, but of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil you shall not eat, for in the day that you eat of it, you will surely die." The point that Moses was making to Israel is a very simple principle, and the principle is this. Sin has consequences. That everything you do matters. That sin matters. Now we hear that word sin, and it's not a popular word anymore. As a matter of fact, it's kind of considered by most people to be a religious word or even a biblical word, a Christian word. It's not one of those words that people like very much. They have other words for it. They call it a mistake, or they call it something like a shortcoming. They don't call it sin anymore, though. And they play it off as not being all that big of a deal. But I want to tell you something. It's a big deal to God, and it ought to be a big deal to us. It should have been a big deal to Adam and Eve, and I want us to look at it this morning and see what took place in the beginning and how it can help us to move forward a little better in the future. Going forward, let's define sin first off. Sin is any disobedience or departure from God's standard. We depart from God's standard, we disobey God's laws, God's word. That's called in the scripture sin. We depart, God calls that sin. So God creates man, gives him life, and then he says, this is how life works, and he puts a warning label on life. Let's break it down and look at it just little by little here. First thing he says is, you may freely eat of every tree of the garden. Do you see that word right in the middle of that? He says freely. Did you know that God is the author of freedom? That freedom began with him. America didn't come up with the idea. It didn't begin in 1776. Freedom was God's idea, and right from the start, he says, you may freely eat from every tree in the garden. He says, you can eat all you want. You can eat any time you want. You can eat as much as you want. You can have apples for breakfast, bananas for lunch. You can have pears for supper, and you can have them every day. All that you want, you have it. It's there. Everything I've provided for you, you can have at it. Maximum freedom. I started to put watermelon in there, and I realized watermelon doesn't grow on trees, so that didn't apply, but that's my favorite. Anyway, you can have all the fruit you want. There's no limitations. But I want us to understand something this morning. The concept of freedom is meaningless without boundaries. Meaningless without boundaries. You see, if you're free to eat, then you're free not to eat, right? If you're free to eat, you're free not to eat. Freedom is not freedom if there's no choice. There must be boundaries. Let's take a football game. Remove the boundaries, remove the sidelines, remove the end zone line or the touchdown line or the goal line. And let's say a running back decides he don't want to get tackled that day. So he runs off the field, across the sideline, jumps up into the stands, into the concession stand, out into the parking lot. What are you going to have there? You're going to have a lot of chaos. He comes back out of the parking lot, back down through the concession stand, into the stands, back onto the football field. And in the process, Granny's probably got run over by some linebacker who tried to follow him into the stands. You got all this stuff happening, and you've got total chaos. He winds up in the end zone, wants to call it a touchdown. Let me give you another one. Let's say tomorrow that the state of Tennessee decides that we're no longer going to have driving laws. There's no longer going to be any boundaries. You can drive on both sides of the road, any direction you want to, and it's perfectly legal. You can go any speed you want. No boundaries. You know what's going to happen, right? There's going to be a whole lot of wrecks. There's going to be a whole lot of injuries. There's going to be a whole lot of death. There's going to be a whole lot of people never arriving at where they wanted to go. See, they may say we're free. We're free to drive however we want, but they weren't free to get to where they wanted to go safely, were they? I guarantee you, and even if you do arrive, you're not going to arrive on time. There's going to be too much chaos, too many obstacles in the way. I'm about to give you the boundary, and there was only one in the beginning. Only one law, only one boundary, only one do not that he gave. But he puts a warning label on life. Let me say one more thing about boundaries. And I hope that all of you understand this, and I try to talk to the kids about this, the younger people that they don't seem to understand. They look at God as some tyrant who just wants to impose rules on people just because he can, just because he's God. But God gives us boundaries because he loves us. Did you know that? Let me illustrate. Let's just take the Ten Commandments and illustrate this for just a moment. Let's take the very first one. Thank God for Chip Ingram, who gave us the book about God's boundaries for living. In there, he talks about the first commandment. He presented it this way. I read this book a couple years ago. I've never forgot this. He said, the very first commandment that he gave us, thou shalt not have any other gods before me. Now, if you read that on the surface, you look at it and say, we must have a narcissistic God. He doesn't want us giving his attention to anybody else, and that is true. But there's a reason for that. It's because he loves us. He knows he's the only true God. He knows he's the creator of the universe. He knows what's best for us. So he says, if you'll make me your God, life will go well for you. Because if you make money your God, and a pandemic hits and a recession follows, you're going to get let down. You're going to be in trouble. If you make family your God and then you lose family, all of a sudden, you're in trouble. You're in pain. You don't know where to turn. You don't know what to do. He says, but if you'll make me your God, if you'll make me the center of everything, then when things go wrong, I'm there. I'm not going anywhere. I'm going to take care. I'm going to provide. I'm going to be who I said I was going to be. It's Father's Day, so let's look at one more before we move on. The Scriptures tell us to honor your father and mother. Now, children, how's God being loving? Teenagers, how is God being loving when he gives us that command? Well, parents have been around a little longer than their children. They've lived a little bit of life. They've messed up some, too, so they know what happens when you mess up, and they know what mess up is and what's not. So when they tell you something, it's good to listen to them. God says, if you'll listen to your parents, especially if you have good ones. There's a lot of good ones in here today. If you'll listen to your parents, if you'll listen to your mom and your dad, things will go well for you. You see how love's behind every command that he gives us? God says, and here's the warning, don't eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, because if you do, it'll kill you. He says it'll kill you. You're dead. In other words, if you eat from that tree, you'll lose access to all the other trees. See, God had provided everything. But he says, if you eat from the tree in the center of the garden, remember, they got kicked out. They lost access to all the other trees. They no longer could have apples for breakfast and pears for lunch and watermelon for supper, even though that doesn't grow on trees. Let's talk about trees for a minute. Let's examine that for a second. I had a couple of questions early on reading this, and I thought about this for years, but one of the questions I had is, why name the tree of the knowledge of good and evil? Why do that? I'd have called it the killing tree. I'd have called it the tree of death. I mean, if God says if I eat from it that I will surely die, then why is it called the tree of the knowledge of good and evil? Well, you know why, and this is where, and I think there's some metaphor involved in naming the tree. You see, the essence of sin is when you and I decide that we're better off deciding what's good and what's evil for ourselves than God is. The essence of sin is we say, I want to be my own God. I want to decide what's wrong and what's right for me. And I don't want anybody else to tell me what's right and wrong for me. We love that word in America, especially that word autonomy. I've often wondered, though, what happens when one person's autonomy is in direct conflict with somebody else's. God knew that He was the only God that could take care of us the way we're to be taken care of. The only God that could guide us where we needed to go. The only God who truly knew what was right and wrong. So He said, don't you eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And that's why He named it that. I got another question. Why did He put it in the center of the garden? Get over into chapter 3. And it tells us that it was right in the middle of the garden. I mean, why not put that in a corner? You've been in people's homes before and they got little trees over in the corner. I mean, that's where I'd have put that tree. I wouldn't have put it in the center of the garden where I have to walk past it every single day, no matter which direction I'm going. I got to pass by the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. He puts it right in the center of the garden. And you know why He did that? He did that because He wants us to know this was to be a perpetual reminder that they were under the authority of somebody else. That God is in charge here. We're not to determine good and evil, bad and good, better and worse, yes and no, up and down for ourselves, independently of God. You're not to get your knowledge on your own about which way to go and what to do. He said, don't mess with this tree where you determine what's right and wrong. Have you ever had one of your kids come home and, man, this happens so much, and we're raising my niece now, and this happens often sometimes, and they'll come home and they'll quote somebody, maybe a friend or a Facebook post or something. And they're talking about this person like they know what they're talking about, this person they're getting their information from, and you know that they don't. You know that that person doesn't know what they're talking about. You know, regardless of what it is, a cousin, a friend, Facebook, the media, a politician somewhere. What do you think the God of the universe thinks when you choose human opinion, you and I, over divine revelation, over the wisdom of the ages, wisdom that is held true now for thousands and thousands of years? What do you think He thinks when you and I choose to trust ourselves or the opinion of somebody else or the knowledge of somebody else over His? About the way you feel when your kid comes home quoting some knucklehead that thinks he knows something and you know that he don't. So God says, live it up with every other tree. You're free except for the tree in the center of the garden. You eat from that one and you will surely, surely die. But the serpent comes along and says, no, you won't. You won't die. I heard a illustration this week from a well-known pastor that may help us understand a little bit about what the devil is up to, what the serpent was up to, and what he's still up to today. It's a story about a farmer and his wife. And they're at home and they receive a package. A package comes in the mail and there's a mouse outside. He's looking through a little hole in the house and he sees them open the package and take it out, and it's a mouse trap. And the mouse says, "Oh no." So he goes out to the barn and he goes up to the chicken and he says, "You're not going to believe the package that the farmer received today. He received a mouse trap." Chicken says, "Oh, that's not good for you. I feel sorry for you." Well, the mouse went on then and he goes to the pig. And he says, "Pig, listen, I've got some bad news. The farmer got a mouse trap in the mail today." And the pig says, "Man, I'm going to be praying for you. That's bad news." He moves on to the cow and he goes up to the cow and he says, "Listen, cow," he said, "I got bad news. The farmer got a mouse trap in the mail today." The cow says, "I weigh over 500 pounds. What's that got to do with me? I'm not worried about no mouse trap." Well, that night, the lady's in bed. She hears the mouse trap go off. She goes to check on it, and she gets to the mouse trap, and she sees that there's a snake caught in the mouse trap. Its tail's caught in the trap. She walks over to it. The problem was that she got too close. It's a poisonous snake. Snake bites her. Poison works up into her body, and she has to be taken to the hospital. Her husband rushes her into the hospital, and they give her an anecdote, and he says, "This ought to work. I'm hoping it will. I think it will. But in the meantime, I want you to put her on a regimen of chicken soup." So he goes home. He goes out to the barn. He gets the chicken, cuts his head off, comes in, chicken soup for the wife ever so often, and she's being taken care of with the chicken soup. He has to continue to work, and he doesn't want to leave her alone, so he lines up three or four different people to come sit with her and watch her during the day while he's out on the farm. And he realizes that if I'm going to have people come over, I'm going to have to do something for them. So I need to provide some meals. He goes out to the barn, slaughters the pig, and they're having bacon for breakfast and pork chops for lunch and more pork chops for supper. Bad news was, wife didn't make it. The anecdote didn't work. She dies, and he's about to have hundreds of people over to his house after the funeral. You know how we like to eat after funerals. So he has the cow slaughtered and cuts it up, and man, they're having hamburgers and filet mignon and T-bone steaks, and they're living it up. And the mouse said this after all this had happened. He said, "I told you that the farmer got a mouse trap. I told you that the farmer got a mouse trap." You see, you and I have no idea what the devil is up to and how things can snowball in your life because you make one wrong decision. Some of you in this room, and I was there for many years, I'll be honest with you, some of you in this room are still reeling from a bad decision, from a sin that you made years ago. You're still dealing with it. Or you're still feeling some sort of guilt or some sort of shame over something you did. Here Eve is dealing with the serpent. Never calls him the devil there, but we know who he is. She's dealing with the devil, and he says, "You're not going to die. You will not surely die." And when they ate, they didn't kill over from a heart attack or have a stroke and die there on the spot. But there was a death that occurred. Scripturally, when you define death, or when death is used in the Bible, almost every time it's used, unless it's talking about somebody physically dying, it doesn't mean death like we think of death. When we think of death, we think of a man or a woman in a casket who no longer breathes, who no longer can walk around and live life. They're in a casket and they're 6 feet under the ground. When we think of death, that's what we think about. That's not what the Bible talks about when it uses the word death. A good synonym for death in the Bible is separation. And a whole lot of separation took place that day. Let me give you just a few. First of all, there was a spiritual separation, a spiritual death. They'd been walking in the cool of the day with God. You ever thought about that? Man, that must have been awesome. They were walking in the cool of the day with the Creator every day. God would come down and they communed with God. They were friends with God. Sin enters in and now they're running and hiding, right? A separation occurred. Not only was there a spiritual separation that took place, there was a relational death that took place. It wasn't long after this that man and woman were at odds with one another, arguing. You remember how it went, don't you? God comes down, He's mediating this thing, and He's talking to Adam. He says, Adam, what have you done? Have you eaten from the tree that I told you not to eat from? And Adam says, she made me do it. Oh, he even adds something to it. He even throws some blame on God there. He says, the woman you gave me handed the fruit. I know some of you men have done that because some of you have been through this type of situation. You may have gone back in your prayer, place of prayer and said, God, why'd you put this woman in my way? Here Adam's going, the woman you gave me. And that works for the women too. It works both ways. Eve says, the serpent made me do it. He's the one who talked me into it. In chapter 3, it says that Eve, there was a curse there. It says, Eve, your desire from this day forward will be for your husband. I don't know if we interpret that right or not. That doesn't mean that she's going to physically desire her husband from that day forward. That means that she's going to desire to be in his place in the home from that day forward. Let me translate. That's saying that man and woman are going to be in a power struggle from now until eternity because of what happened on that day. A relational death took place. And it carried over into their children and parents, fathers, it's Father's Day. Understand this, you will leave a legacy to your children, whether it's good or whether it's bad. And the legacy that they left their children led Cain to kill his brother. A relational death had taken place in that family. Not only was there a spiritual death and a relational death, but there was an emotional death that took place. Remember at the end of chapter 2, after God had made everything and He said, it is good. Everything is good. And He says, they were naked and they were not ashamed. Well, after they eat from the tree they weren't supposed to eat from, they're ashamed. They know they're naked. They're trying to cover their nakedness. It also says they were afraid. An emotional death took place. They didn't like themselves anymore. And by the way, that's one of the worst kinds of death. One of the worst kinds of separation is when you can no longer stand you anymore. When you're tired of looking in the mirror because you don't like who you've become. An emotional death takes place. An environmental death took place. All kinds of things started happening. As a matter of fact, they didn't get to live there anymore. Their environment totally changed. They get kicked out of the garden. The ground, it says, was cursed. There were thorns and thistles. By the way, there was an occupational death that took place. Adam didn't get to do the job he did before, did he? He was tending the garden, taking care of all that God had made. Now he's tilling the ground by the sweat of his brow. Everything changed that day. All types of death and all types of separation took place. And eventually, they did physically die and returned to the ground. Are you tired of all that death yet? I am. In this room, anytime there's this many people, in this room, there's some people that are going through separation, through a death. Some area of your life where you're dealing with the consequences of your sin. But how did Adam and Eve get there? How did this happen? How did they wind up in this shape? Well, we already know that it's because they failed to pay attention to the warning label. But how did that happen? Genesis chapter 3, verse 6, it says, "So when the woman saw that the tree was good for food." Let me repeat that. The woman saw that the tree was good for food. Did you catch it there? She'd seen this tree 1,000 times. She even told the serpent about it, remember? She said, God said we couldn't eat from it, and then she even added, we can't even touch it. So, why now does it say, you know, when she saw that it was good for food? Here's why. The serpent gave her a different picture of the tree. He caused her to see it in a different way. He caused her to see something that she knew was wrong, that she knew she wasn't supposed to touch, that she knew she wasn't supposed to eat from, and he made it look so enticing, he made it look so different, he made it look so desirable, that now all of a sudden she's like, man, that looks good. For all this time, that didn't look so good. God told us to stay away from that. But all of a sudden now, it looks pretty good. Man, do you see that in our culture, by the way? I wish we could go back and see the things that were totally not accepted 50 years ago, 100 years ago, and all of a sudden now, man, they're okay. It's okay now to kill babies. It's okay now to marry somebody from the same sex. But let me tell you something, 50 years ago, we wouldn't have dreamed of anything like that, but we've eaten from the wrong tree. The devil's presented us a different picture of what's going on, and we've bought into it. Let's read that again. I want to look at one more thing. It says, "So when the woman saw that the tree was good for food." See, the tree was not only good, it was evil. But the serpent only showed her the good part. Man, when you see that woman at the workplace that looks really, really good, but you've got a loving wife at home, he only shows you the good part. Man, she's really into me. She digs me. She thinks I'm good looking. It's obvious. She wants to get to know me better. I think I'll just, this looks good. I think I'm gonna dive in. A few months down the road, your children can't stand you because you destroyed their home. You've lost your wife. You've got half the income you did before, so you can't afford the things you used to afford. I mean, we could go on and on. Your life all of a sudden now is a mess. He didn't show you that part. You see, anytime we live our lives independent of what God says about things, and I hope you're educating yourself on what God says about things, it's in the Bible. You need to pick it up, you need to read it, you need to study it, you need to know what God says about things. And we get our information from the wrong place. When we eat the wrong tree, then a separation occurs. Death occurs. James 1:15 says, "When sin is conceived, it brings forth death." And then you know what happens? Because we're dead and we want to feel alive, we chase after anything. Whether it's alcohol, whether it's drugs, sex, busyness. I watch a lot of people, they're on their phones all the time. I mean, any spare time they've got, they're on their phone. You know why? They don't want to think. Because when they think and they're not filling their mind with all this stuff, they think about how dead they are. They think about how bad their life is, and they don't want to think about that. They certainly don't want to do anything to try to correct it. So they just fill their mind up with all this stuff, and they go on. They're trying to avoid the death that has occurred in their life. Now I want us to get off of this for a minute. I want us to fast forward in time thousands of years from the time of Adam and Eve. I want to lead into it by reading to you what 1 Corinthians 15:22 talks about. It says, "In Adam all die, even so in Christ all shall be made alive. And then down in verse 45, you see Adam ruined things, but the last Adam reversed the curse. It says there and refers to Jesus as the last Adam, who was a life-giving spirit. Let me close with an episode from the life of Jesus. It's found in John chapter 11. Perhaps you are familiar with the story. It's here that Jesus has a date with death. Mary and Martha come to him. He's away. But they don't come to him. They send him a message that their brother Lazarus, it says that Jesus loved, is sick. Real sick. A sickness that may lead to him dying. And they believe that Jesus is the only one who can do anything about it. Funny thing is, in that story, Jesus intentionally waits 2 more days before he even heads back to the home of Lazarus, Mary, and Martha. He waits 2 more days. He arrives there, and now it's been 4 days, and Lazarus is already dead. He's been dead for 4 days. And Jesus gets there, and this is one of the most amazing places in Scripture. I think one of the key events in the life of Jesus. He gets there, and he's emotional. 3 places it talks about. In verse 35, you know it. It says that when Jesus saw the tears of Mary and Martha, that he burst into tears and he wept. It said Jesus wept. But in verse 33 and in verse 38, it gives us a different type of emotion. It says there that Jesus was, the translation was filled with anger that led to a groaning, and that he was troubled. What was he troubled about? He was tired of seeing death reign. I mean, look at all the sadness. Look at what's happening to his friends. He was close to this family. You got to remember, he was there in the beginning too. He was there. He was a part of creation. I mean, a part of creating. John 1 tells us that. He was there and he saw Adam and Eve do what they did. He was there that day. He saw what happened after. He saw Cain strike down his brother Abel. He saw all the pain. And he saw all the hurt. And he saw all the trouble. And he saw all the lives that were ruined because they wouldn't heed the warning. And Jesus comes that day to the house of Mary and Martha and Lazarus, and he said, it's time for death to lose its power. I'm tired of this. It's time for it to end. And he stands in front of the tomb of Lazarus, and he says, Lazarus, come out. And he does. But there's more to it than that. There was a more dramatic thing going on than just that event. If you read in Mark chapter 5, when Jesus raised Jairus' daughter from the dead, he made people leave the room. Remember, just a few got to stay. And then after he raised her from the dead, he looked at the ones that were still in the room and he said, don't tell anybody. Don't tell anybody. Kind of strange. But here, there's people everywhere. They're witnessing this. And Jesus, in front of all of them, does something that's going to get him in a whole lot of trouble. He says, Lazarus, come out. And Lazarus comes out, and all these people see it. And suddenly, there's a few, it tells us in the Scriptures, there's a few later that go to the Pharisees and say, listen, this Jesus of Nazareth, he's doing all these signs, he's doing all these wonders, he's doing all these miracles, and now he's raised a man who had been dead for 4 days. See, that got everybody's attention because the Jew believed that the soul left the body after 3 days. So there's no other explanation there than that Jesus raised a man who was gone, who was dead, whose body had been separated from his soul. And he did it in public because he had another date with death. He says, and he doesn't say in verse 50, but Caiaphas, the high priest, prophesied that day. Here's what he said. He said, "It is expedient for us, in light of everything that's happening, in light of the fact that this man's going to start gaining followers, a council had been gathered together, and they had to make a decision about what to do with Jesus. And Caiaphas speaks up and says, it is expedient for us that one man die for the people, and not that the whole nation should perish." Verse 53 says, "From that day forward, they plotted to put him to death." You see what Jesus was really up to that day? Why he did it in public was because he knew what would happen. And he knew that now his Father's plan was being enacted. He knew now that they were going to kill him. He knew now that he was headed to another tree. The tree that for you and I is the tree of life. And when he was on that tree, a death occurred. But I'm not talking about the time in which he actually breathed his last breath. I'm talking about that moment of separation. You know what I'm talking about. We talk about it at Easter time. Where Jesus cries out, and I can't imagine. He cries out, my God, why have you forsaken me?" I was listening to Tim Keller speak, and he said, you know, for them to write this meant it really must have happened. He was talking to the skeptics. He says, because every other religious leader, Muhammad, was surrounded by his family and friends, died this nice, peaceful death. Same thing with Buddha. But here Jesus, it's recorded that his followers, now if you're trying to gain a follower and you don't present your founder's death this way, but Jesus cries out, my God, why have you forsaken me?" They never forgot that day. That's the reason it's recorded. And I don't want you to forget it either. Because that's the day that the curse of Adam, that all the consequences of sin could stop. Now you're not going to, you can't escape the consequences that you're suffering from past sins. But now he comes and he gives us the power and the spirit to lead us into the future, eating from the right tree, making the right decisions, so that we might have life. Now some of you are going to leave here today and you're going to say, you know, me and death, we're doing just fine. Don't worry about me. Consequences come, that's okay. Me and death are doing just fine. But if you're tired of it, if you're tired of making the wrong decisions, if you're tired of doing the wrong things, if you're tired of eating from the wrong tree and you want life to change, then this sermon is for you. Will you come this morning? Jesus is waiting on you. Will you come?